Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 10th, 1998. In the Koinonia Creekside room this morning is Thelma McGill Cobbler. Today's session number is 98-5, and it's titled, Women and Men on the Way of the Cross. What Scriptural Clues Give Hope for a Community of Women and Men Following Christ? Let's listen in.
Men, exactly what you want for yourselves. Interesting occupation, reasonable freedom for their pleasures, and a sufficient emotional outlet. What form the occupation, the pleasures, and emotion may take depends entirely on the individual. You know that this is so with yourselves. Why will you not believe it is so with us? The late D.H. Lawrence, who certainly cannot be accused of underrating the importance of sex, and had a good deal of nonsense upon the subject, was yet occasionally visited by shattering glimpses of the obvious. He said in one of his assorted articles, quote, man is willing to accept woman as an equal, as a man in skirts, as an angel, a devil, a baby face, a machine, an instrument, a bosom, a womb, a pair of legs, a servant, an encyclopedia, an ideal, or an obscenity. The one thing he won't accept her as is a human being, an ordinary human being of the feminine sex. End of quote. At the beginning of this series, I said that feminist theology is theology that is committed to the full humanity of women. And the question that I want you to think about as I make my presentation today is, how can women and men recognize each other as fully human, journeying on the way of the cross? What we'll do is we'll look at some resources from the tradition, some New Testament texts, and also the thought of Simone Weil and Arthur McGill, who, while he's not writing from a feminist perspective, has some important things to say about self-giving love. So, what do women want? To be treated as human beings. But that's the hardest thing for us to do with one another, is to treat one another as human beings. Rosemary Ruther has talked about the ongoing journey of conversion from sexism. And because we're all infected by the sin of sexism, it's very hard for us to see one another as human beings. But it's not a new problem. And as we think about what following Christ on the way of the cross means for this issue, I want you to think with me about the three passion predictions in the Gospel of Mark. Because there, what Jesus is about on his journey to Jerusalem comes up against some resistance on the part of his followers. So I think this will be helpful to us. Because at the point of the passion predictions, they begin to find out what following Christ truly means. And the first passion prediction is in the 8th chapter. And what happens is that Peter answers Jesus' question, who do people say that I am, with a confession that Jesus is the Messiah. Then Jesus immediately begins to explain that he must suffer and die, and he will be handed over to the religious authorities, and he will rise again. I think it's very important to notice Peter's immediate response. He takes Jesus aside and rebukes him and says, essentially, we're assuming this can't be. Jesus then rebukes him and calls him Satan. It's like a new temptation of Christ, a temptation to divert from his path to Jerusalem and perhaps assume some other kind of power than he is going to show them. But Jesus then calls the crowd with his disciples and says, if anyone wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. I want to emphasize the fact that in this first prediction, it's the religious elites that are going to put Jesus to death. Every time there's a passion prediction, it's slightly different. The religious elites are the ones that have grown in their opposition to Jesus as he begins to say who is a part of his following, a part of his community, and people are included not on the basis of the cult or on the basis of lines dividing clean from unclean, but simply by association with Jesus. Peter, as the one who has just confessed Jesus as the Messiah, ought to know better than to try to tell Jesus what his mission is. The religious elites ought to know better, and they ought to know what Jesus is about, but they are the ones that are going to kill him. They are going to turn on him. But Jesus' way is a way of taking the place of the least, and that becomes even more clear in the second passion prediction. One of the things that happens after Jesus is named as Messiah is that all the moving around in circles or unclear directions begins to settle down, and they begin to move toward Jerusalem. They are passing through Galilee, and Jesus did not want anyone to know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him. And 3 days after being killed, he will rise again. But they did not understand what he was saying, and were afraid to ask him. In the first prediction, chapter 9, verse 30 is the beginning of it. And in the first prediction, Peter simply balks. In the second prediction, they don't get it, they don't understand, and they're afraid to ask. Maybe they're reluctant. Maybe they're reluctant to follow on this path that is going to lead to his death, because it might mean their death too. It's only logical. I think it's important that in the second prediction, it's human hands. I think this is a sign that Christ is handed over to humanity, and what we do with Jesus is what we often do to each other. We are cruel. We often want to exercise power over one another. He will be betrayed and killed, and in 3 days rise again. One of the reasons maybe why they don't understand is because they're preoccupied. At least if you take the next passage as part of the context. They travel on to Capernaum, and while he is in the house, he asks them, and what were you talking about on the road? It's as if they've already forgotten that Jesus is going to die. We get this kind of news, it's usually the only thing on our minds, but not for the followers of Jesus. And they were silent because on the way they had argued with one another who was the greatest. So he sat down and called the 12 and said, whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. And he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. A child, the least, someone that is not powerful, this is what it means to accept the kingdom of God, not what they were talking about on the road, being the greatest. And then the third comes from chapter 10. It starts at verse 32. They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those that followed were afraid. He took the 12 aside again and began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death. And then they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit upon him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise again." Now here I want you to visualize the opening of the passage. Jesus is set on the path to Jerusalem. They're getting near the city. Where is Jesus? He's charging ahead. He knows where he's going. He's going to tell them that this is what he has to do. Where are they? They're behind somewhere. Jesus is ahead of them. They are amazed and in fear, totally disoriented. They refuse to see what is happening. And yet the description this time is as vivid as it can get of the suffering that he's going to go through. And notice that there's this additional prediction now. The elites are going to condemn him, but look at what power the Gentiles have. Look at what they're able to do. They're the authorities. They're the ones that are in charge of the political process. They're the ones that will, in fact, crucify him and take him through that whole bloody process that involves stripping and beating and mocking and being spat upon and being humiliated utterly. That's what happens when he's turned over to the authorities. That's the power of the Gentiles. Now, they've just heard what the Gentiles are able to do to Jesus. But where does the conversation go? The next passage is James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Like a good teacher, he says, "Well, what's the question before I say yes?" Or a good parent. "What is it you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" And they replied, "We are able." Then Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." When they heard this, the ten began to be angry with James and John. So Jesus called them and said to them, "You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be the slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." What I want to focus on here is that there's a description of how the community among them is supposed to be, how it's supposed to work. And it's diametrically opposed to the way Gentiles use power. He says that the Gentiles have rulers that lord it over them. And isn't this the case? I mean, it's not that much different today. Everybody, you know, says we get the rulers that we deserve. In a sense, everyone in a system of hierarchical power plays a role, whether they're weak or they're strong. It's not that we always buy into it, but whether we will to or not, we often are seduced by it, and we begin to worship that kind of power. We begin to wish, perhaps, that the power would change hands. But what we don't question enough is that kind of power that lords it over others. In the context of the time, peasant farmers were losing their lands. There were many properties that went into default over taxes. They knew very well in concrete terms what it meant to have tyrants. And yet they were holding this discussion about wanting to have the best seats. Very interesting. Jesus is going to the cross, and the followers are worried about what kind of seats they're going to get in the kingdom. Jesus tells them, well, if you follow me, you will be baptized with my baptism, and you will drink my cup. But this question about getting the best seats in the kingdom isn't one that I'm going to solve. One of the things that has really helped me understand why the followers of Jesus are so reluctant at this point where Jesus is going to his death is that Jesus is telling them something that is so opposed to the way we usually think about power. And the person who has helped me think about this is Simone Weil. I mentioned the other day that in order to say anything about Simone Weil's thought, it's always important to say just a word or two about her life. She was a French woman who was teaching philosophy in a school for girls before World War II. And she, as a philosopher, had things to say and write about oppression, which concerned her greatly. And she was in many ways a political radical and activist, but there was something missing in her analysis, she thought. She wanted to find out what it really meant to suffer oppression. And so she left her teaching and decided to work at a factory, a Renault factory, on the assembly line. And what she found out there was that she and the other workers were so mistreated by the inequality of power that she began to feel that she was no more than a slave. She was so much pushed around and verbally abused in the workplace that when she would leave work, she couldn't quite believe that people would treat her decently. It just didn't seem right. She didn't have that confidence and concept of herself as a full human being. Her humanity had been diminished. Now, one of the other things that she talks about is the nature of this relationship of unequal power. What is it when we're talking about force or lording it over others? And she tells a story that comes from Greek history, the story of the people of the island of Melos when the Athenians were at war with the Spartans. That will sort of give us a glimpse of some of her thoughts about power that is domination over others. The people of Melos were in league with neither the Athenians or the Spartans, but they were a threat to the Athenians. And the Athenians, who greatly outnumbered them and also were much more powerful than they were, came to them with an ultimatum. And they said, you can give in to us, or we will completely overrun your island, put all your men to death, and sell your women and children into slavery. That was the ultimatum, and then they argued with one another. Now the people of Melos tried to say, this is not just. What you're doing is unfair, and besides that, because it's unfair, we not only have justice on our side, but the gods will protect us. We would rather die than be slaves, but know that what you propose to do is not just. And then the Athenians, for their part, said something very interesting. They said, well, justice really only matters in human affairs when there's some kind of parity. Because it's human nature that if there's a great inequality of power, the strong will command where they have the power to do so. The strong will command where they have the power to do so. Might rules. And they didn't say it was right, but they just recognized that it was a kind of universal law. The people of Melos said, well, but the gods will be on our side. And the Athenians said, I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't count on it. And not only that, but this is, after all, a universal law of the way human beings treat one another. We didn't create it, and we won't be the last to use it. And so you can imagine what happened. They overran the island of Melos. They put all the men to death, and they sold the women and the children into slavery. Now, Simone Weil, a woman who was very much intrigued by, fascinated by, the Christian gospel and the figure of Christ, said, what does this kind of power have to do with the Christian God? And someone that I think says something very similar, Arthur McGill, says, in fact, force is no attribute of God. God's power is very different. they says force, the power to command wherever we have the ammunition, is entirely different from the way God acts. For instance, in the creation, God is already all in all. God is already in community in the Trinity. But God, out of graciousness and out of love, wills for there to be genuine otherness. And that means that God is going to have to give something up. God is going to have to give up being all things. Now there are going to be things besides God. It's very different from the way human beings act. She says that human sinfulness is that we want to be all things. We want to be the center, and we don't make room for others. But in creation, God makes room, pulls back, so that there can be genuine otherness, genuine freedom. And she says, this is a crucifixion long before the cross of Jesus. This is God's way. It's the power that creates the world, but it's a power of renunciation, a power that creates freedom and otherness. It's not the power of force, because when God creates the world, if you notice, even at Holden, we're not overwhelmed by God popping up everywhere and telling us what to do and when to do it. The world runs on its own. God has given the world laws that she calls gravity, and these enable us to have some distance from God and some freedom from God. Because God wants us to love out of freedom. If God were constantly overwhelming us, that wouldn't be love. That wouldn't be love. That's not God's way. So God makes room for others in creation, and then God is hidden. God is hidden. And we then are creatures who do experience distance from God. And we do experience these laws pressing on us and limiting us. And all of this is a part of our distance from God. Now, she says, how we respond to that makes all the difference. Will we now try to manipulate the forces around us and make others subject to us the way we are subject to the laws of nature? Or will we accept our limitations and will we treat others as human and limited and mortal in the way that we are? What kind of stance will we take? Will we go God's way, in which force is no attribute, or will we go the way of the Gentiles, the way of the Athenians? She says, God isn't like the Athenians. It's a miraculous thing, but God does not always command, even in the situations where we just wish God would come in and fix it and set it right kind of magically. She said, no, there's a reason why God doesn't work that way. And that is the way that God has structured the world. But only in this way is genuine love possible. Now, what happens when people do manipulate force and turn it to their own advantage and try to subject people to gravity, to put people lower, as it were, on the scale of force, is then affliction. And this is what she experienced in her work at the Renault factory. And she said that the affliction was, and I'll only name these because I'm going to tell you a story in which all of these dimensions are acutely present. When force enters the soul, she said, then if it's extreme enough, we become a thing. We become like a stone. We don't have any sense of our own humanity left. The first thing, of course, is the physical aspect of affliction. And this is what we always think of in terms of pain. That's how we know something is wrong. She said it rivets our attention to what is happening. And she said, by the way, anybody that only has emotional suffering, as we sometimes read about in certain kinds of poetry, she says, is sheer romanticism. She was always concerned for people that are materially oppressed. And she says, even when we grieve, what happens? We get a tightness in the chest. We get a constriction in the throat, right? Mm-hmm. You feel it in your body. That's part of affliction. When somebody that you love has died or you're in grief. And then there's a social aspect to affliction. It would be wonderful, again, to idealize and romanticize the human condition. But she says, in nature, when a hen is wounded, the other hens rush in and peck at it. And I don't think it was the same thing that was going on in Africa, because she said they really wound the hen, and they have, of course, no sense of leaving the hen alone. We as human beings are often repulsed by those that are either weaker or in much worse straits. Physical suffering often repels us. I have to tell you that when I visited Dachau concentration camp, I hadn't read Simone Weil yet, and they have huge, larger-than-life pictures, at least they did when I visited, of, I think they were men, but it's honestly hard to tell human beings in these, of course you've seen them, the horrible camp attire, unshaven, like skeletons with their eyes just so wide and empty. And I remember thinking, I'm not feeling the way I want to feel about these pictures. I was repelled by them. There is something that makes us shield ourselves from extreme suffering. And she was aware of that because of her experiences. This is part of the social dimension. This is why people are ostracized and shamed. And honesty about that is important. And then the internalization of all of this, her experience of feeling no more than a slave when she was in the factory. She says it's the equivalent of being made into a thing. And I love the image of being a stone. She says, if there is a slave, and one says to a slave, chase that dog away, it's no different from chasing the dog away by throwing a stone. The one who is in power has the power to chase the dog away by whatever means they desire. And of course that has an impact then on the person who is treated as a slave. Psychologically, they will internalize that. So this is, of course, the opposite of treating one another as fully human. And I want you to hear the beginning of a story that shows that aspect of affliction and shaming and degradation. And then we can talk a little bit about how that gets transformed when we reject this idea of the power of the Gentiles using force on one another. The story comes from In Search for Our Mother's Gardens by Alice Walker. And the last part of the story I will read to you. But the first part I will simply summarize. She begins when she was three, and she was reading a poem in church. And the congregation saw her confidence, saw that she was a lovely child, and they would say things like, that girl is a mess. And they admired her sassiness and her courage. And this is the way she was as a very young girl. Her father used to pick her out of all the children to take her to the fair because she was so pretty. She said, take me, I'm the prettiest. And he would show her off. And she said she really liked being sassy and she really liked being cute. But then one day it ended. And it ended when she was 8. She was a tomboy and she was playing with her brothers. And her brothers had been given new toys. They'd been given guns, not real guns, BB guns, which they would use to shoot birds and things and just about anything that was in sight. But she was a girl, and as a girl, she was not given a BB gun. And suddenly, she said, there was a great distance between them. They used to play Hopalong Cassidy and cowboys and everything. She said, when they got the BB guns and I didn't, I was the Indian. I was the Indian. She said, they shot at everything in sight and I tried to keep up with my bows and arrows. And then one day, she was out playing and she felt a pain in her eye. And she saw one of her brothers lower his gun. And she was upset, but they rushed to her and they said, now you can't tell what happened. You can't tell what happened, because we'll get whipped and you don't want that to happen, do you? And she said, no, I didn't want that to happen because if they got whipped, they would have ways of taking it out on me. And they picked up a piece of wire and they said, tell our parents that you stepped on this wire and it flew in your face. And she just agreed. She just wanted to do anything that would get her to her mother. And so they stuck to the lie. And her mother tried to comfort her. And in fact, they tried, as rural people often do, to treat it at home. And when they realized that she wasn't getting any better, they took her to a doctor. The doctor said something that really scared her. He said that the one eye, which had gone blind, might also make the other eye go blind. And frightened as she was, as she grew and the scar healed, she said what bothered her the most, although she was still scared about losing her sight, was this big white glob of a scar, because now she wasn't cute anymore. And she said she wouldn't look at people in the face for years after that. Not for years would she look up. When she was 12, she remembers a time that family came to the house and she just hid in her room, ashamed. And when one of her cousins said, "You can't see out of that eye yet, can you?" And she said, "No." She just looked in the mirror and cursed her eye. She hated it. And she said she prayed a prayer that night. She said, "I didn't pray for sight. I prayed for beauty." So, this is a story that I think is so beautifully told because it illustrates what we were talking about the other day. I used the image from Catherine Patterson, the writer and I think maybe the theologian who, like a spider, spins a thread out of their own insides. And of course, Alice Walker does that. And then she does weave it into a pattern. But I'm going to hold off for a minute and say a few things about the cross. They has said that in creation, we do experience distance from God. And because we're mortal, we are subject to others who will lord it over us and afflict us. And yet, as Christians, our call is not to lord it over others, but to follow in the way of the cross. And the way she describes Jesus on the cross is that he also shows us the love of God. Just as in creation, God is self-giving love and allows the creation to be, at the cross, there is a renunciation that takes place in God. And the renunciation is that although force is turned against Jesus, he does not in turn try to lord it over others. When Jesus comes, he does not come as one who commands wherever he will, but he comes as one who invites. He's met with scorn. He's afflicted in every way that human beings can be afflicted. He loses everything. His followers betray him. He undergoes every aspect. Psychological, he is abandoned by God. He has no hope, she says, that he will be successful, even though he is following faithfully on the path which leads to his death. That is not granted to him. And of course, his followers forsake him, and he is subject to the most extreme torture. But she says what happens in that extreme affliction that he experiences is, in his abandonment, he goes the furthest distance from God in all of creation, because all of the powers of force are focused on him at the cross. And she says, in spite of that power of force that comes down with all the weight of the universe on Christ, there is another kind of power, and that's the power of Trinitarian love. And she says, it's a power that works two ways. It's a power that is so strong that in the Trinity it unites This is her language. She says, two beings, she's talking about the Father and the Son, so that they're indistinguishable. They're so united. But she says, it's a power that is so strong that it can span the infinite distance between God and Jesus abandoned on the cross. And that infinite distance means then that all of our other distances are abandonments. All of the universe, nothing is outside of that love then that spans that infinite distance. That's what happens on the cross. That is what happens because God's way is a way of renunciation that is willing to go that infinite distance for the sake of everything in creation, human beings, our violence, our sin. Arthur McGill, I wonder sometimes, I've got to find out whether he ever read Simone Weil, because there's some uncanny similarities, and I don't know, and you'll notice them too. And I don't know, but he uses the text of the Good Samaritan to talk about how force is no attribute of God, and how the Samaritan really embodies God's love in the way that we also are to embody God's love to one another. And he says, not to retell the whole story, he says, when you look at how the Samaritan responds, just focusing on the Samaritan, notice how extravagant his actions are. He pours oil and wine into the wound. He puts the wounded man on his own beast. He takes him to the inn, and then after he's done all that, he says, and in addition, if anything more is needed, I will pay for it. So he obligates himself to the wounded man. And he says that's so unexpected, so extravagant, and of course the Samaritan himself was an outcast. What could he possibly have expected in return from this man? Probably not even gratitude. So it's sheer self-giving love. And McGill's point is that who of us does that? If we turn this into a moralizing story that just, now go do what the Samaritan does, well, something else needs to happen before we can even come close to what the Samaritan does. He says there is one, however, who is an outcast, who stops at the side of the road, who gives everything that he has and says, and if that isn't enough, I will do more. I will do everything that is required for this wounded and bleeding person, and that's Jesus. So Jesus is the Good Samaritan, and Jesus doesn't expect anything. He doesn't want any reward from this person, but this is sheer self-giving love. Simone Weil adds one thing that I think is very important from a feminist perspective. Sometimes it is said that women give too much of themselves, and these stories can be dangerous because they encourage us to give what we don't have. I think what Weil says is critically important. And it's really the very first thing that happens, maybe the most simple thing, so that we don't think that the Samaritan is simply a kind of heroic story. She says, the first thing is that the man on the side of the road is nothing but a lump of bleeding flesh, stripped naked, powerless, without a hope in the world. The two that have passed by hardly see that this bleeding lump is there. And if they do, they'll forget it 5 minutes later. They don't pay attention. The first thing the Samaritan does is pay attention. And she says, he stops what he's doing and he comes to the assistance of the wounded man. And she says, this is what happens wherever the love of Christ is passed between two people. She says, when there is inequality and someone is in great need and someone stops and pays attention, they literally give that person their humanity back. They give that person their humanity back because that person is too weak to give them anything. And she says that is nothing different from the love of God passed between those two people. And she says it happens where the eyes of the two people meet, before all the heroic measures, simply giving the other person their humanity back. And I think that's so important because there are so many times that we can do good and make other people feel crummy. We can make other people feel really crummy. We may be doing a lot, and we may be laying things on them that we need to lay on them, but there's something about paying attention that restores us to humanity. Well, Bay says that when we pray, we're paying attention, or we're trying to. That's a part of what goes on in the discipline of prayer. And the discipline of prayer can help us to learn to stop what we're doing and pay attention to the people around us so that we're not using them like things. And I want to finish the story by Alice Walker, because it's a child in this story who pays attention. And I think it's a lesson for all of us. In the Christian community, we're called to do this, but we have to recognize that often we're not the ones that do it best. Just because Christ was involved in renouncing power over others, we should get it, we should do it, but sometimes we see it happening on the outside, in unexpected places. And it's also our call to rejoice in that. Well, there were a couple of things that helped Alice Walker look up again. One was a teacher that she had in grammar school, a teacher that loved her before she was born and helped pick out baby clothes for her. And this teacher, of course, did not abandon her or think ill of her when she was not cute anymore. Then there was her brother, who understood her shame, and she got an operation where the ugliest part of the scar was removed, the white part. And that was when she said there was still a bluish crater in her eye, but she felt like she could look up and look in other people's faces. And then things began to happen. She had friends again. She did well in school again because she was looking up. And she was valedictorian of the class and queen. Queen. But of course, in spite of all this, she felt dis-ease with the fact that she was not ever going to regain that beauty that she had. And so from time to time, she would resent her eye, this bluish eye that was so different and had caused her such great shame. And the thing that most of all helped her was this incident. I am 27 and my baby daughter is almost 3. Since her birth, I have worried about her discovery that her mother's eyes are different from other people's. Will she be embarrassed? I think. What will she say? Every day, she watches a television program called The Big Blue Marble. It begins with a picture of the Earth as it appears from the moon. It is bluish, a little battered-looking thing, but full of light with whitish clouds swirling around it. Every time I see it, I weep with love as if it is a picture of Grandma's house. One day, when I am putting Rebecca down for her nap, she suddenly focuses on my eye. Something inside me cringes, gets ready to try to protect myself. All children are cool about physical differences, I know from experience. And that they don't always mean to be is another matter. I assume Rebecca will be the same. But no. She studies my face intently as we stand, her inside and me outside her crib. She even holds my face maternally between her dimpled little hands, then looking every bit as serious and lawyer-like as her father, she says, as if it may just have possibly slipped my attention, "Mommy, there's a world in your eye." As in, don't be alarmed or do anything crazy. And then gently, but with great interest, "Mommy, where did you get that world in your eye?" For the most part, the pain left then. So what if my brothers grew up to buy even more powerful pellet guns for their sons and to carry real guns themselves? So what if a young Morehouse man once nearly fell off the steps of Trevor Arnett Library because he thought my eyes were blue? Crying and laughing, I ran to the bathroom while Rebecca mumbled and sang herself off to sleep. Yes, indeed, I realized looking into the mirror, there was a world in my eye. And I saw that it was possible to love it. That in fact, for all it had taught me of shame and anger and inner vision, I did love it. Paying attention. A wonderful, wonderful gift. A gift that maybe we can learn from this child. And I'm done. The tape can stop. I will stick around if anybody wants to talk or have questions.